So what we're going to do here, we're going to go through MyLS case study. So if while you're watching this, you may want to bring up the this link, which is on the LESS website, the large server hardware company. You can also get to it on agilecarpentry.com and scroll down, and you'll see the timeline, and you'll be able to get to it that way as well. So you know who the two presenters are. I'm just the external coach. I was fortunate to get to spend so much time with this client, and I was very grateful to get to know Mitria better. We're going to go through this case study, and I'm going to skim it, and then we're going to ask questions. And my hope is that a lot of you have done some pre-reading on the case study, and there's even a skimming section on the notes. And so Mitria and I are just going to go through here real quick. Just a little bit of my background. I am a software engineer, as Anthony mentioned. So these are some books that I had that I needed a dummy image from our website. So I put this up there as kind of the history of, you know, I came from a physics background and did some Fortran programming in college. And then oddly, I taught myself object-oriented programming in Perl, which is a strange place to learn it. And eventually I found myself doing a lot of Java development. And over time, I did a lot of trading systems and large e-commerce systems, systems where, you know, continually highly available, always on, hot roles, you know, dozens of teams, and you got to go to sleep at night and the phone didn't ring. And other cases where things were a mess and the phone rang all the time. So been doing consulting for quite a while now. Again, a little bit about me. I am a certified LESS trainer now. Grateful to Victor Gagarik, who was my mentor, and all the time that Greg Larman spent with me and Boss has spent with me, and very grateful for all of the LESS community. And you'll find most of the LESS trainers come from a pretty technical background. Mitria, who we discussed, is very hard-hitting hardware engineer slash manager, and he is Mitria in the case study, and he's Mitria here in a public forum. So he's our mystery man, and he's co-presenting as much as I am. We're going to quickly overview. Let's just focus on qualifying questions during the overview. But please do, if you have, you know, if it's a little confusing what I said, please ask. But what we really want to do is get to the end and do Q&A and spend the vast majority of our time in Q&A. And as we go, it's helpful to write questions down so you can keep them so when we get to the good stuff. Okay, so here is an overview of the system that is involved. This is, it's a server farm. This is a server farm on the pallet with all the necessary hardware, firmware, the management system, the management software that you need to orchestrate this whole thing. All of this is a bundled product that, you know, forklift drops it in your server farm and poof, you now have, you know, a full-blown sophisticated server infrastructure with a lot of blades. So it is a blade architecture, and there is a chassis here that has, you know, each blade is like not unlike your own motherboard in your home PC, except, you know, obviously you have a bunch of them. They're in this backplane in the chassis. There is storage of whatever flavor, and it's modular, but some sort of persistent store is connected to this thing. And up at the top, there is a network device, which is effectively middleware, running an administrative interface, kind of a single pane of glass to allow you to administer the framework as a whole. The types of customers vary. Some of the customers, you know, they might be internet companies that are hosting various web infrastructure. It might be telecommunications companies running cell phone towers. It might be banks running trading systems, it might be research laboratories, and each of those might configure the hardware a little bit differently. They might choose, you know, a different number of CPUs on the board, or a different choice of more or less expensive storage, or various things. But it is in large measure, a single product that has some, you know, configurability as to how much money you want to spend in different components and how do you want to configure it. These are, as you would expect, you know, this is multi-million dollar systems, although they make, you know, hundreds of thousands of them. But when you have a support problem, this is the, you know, first class support. The guys who work in support are paid just as well as the, you know, the more senior software engineers. And if you need them to get on a plane and come to you, they do, right? So they may get on a private jet because you're losing money on your trading platform. This is the typical gold-plated type support that you see in these sort of corporate environments. So that gives you a, you know, context. Middleware to low level. What's interesting here is, so in order to be able to manage the manage these blades, there's a variety of customizations that are done to the BIOS code, and there are, you know, many of these network cards are custom network cards. There is a node controller which is on all the time. So let's say you wanted to reboot that blade. Well, the node controller would always be on because it's running a, you know, a stripped down version of a Linux operating system that is playing an administrative function. And that would be the equivalent to, you know, being able to go hit the power switch yourself. Whenever one wants to make BIOS changes, those come down from the GUI layer or command line equivalent. They go through the blade chassis. They go to the chassis controller. They go into the node controller. And then the node controller goes and contacts the BIOS and has it do whatever setting changes it needs or any other sorts of instrumentation. And the what to take away here from a software engineering / hardware engineering context is that down at this BIOS customization level, this is very, very low level code. They're just lucky that they get to code in C, not C++, C instead of having to write in assembly. And even their standard libraries are not there. There is no operating system in this early boot stage as you're trying to bring up the board. You have to cross-compile and deploy to target. If you're monitoring any tests that are running, all you may have is a serial port that's coming back with those results if you're lucky. So that's the nature, very much low-level firmware flavor of development. On the flip side, oh, and it may be a problem with the hardware because these are like perhaps custom chips from Intel that are pre-production runs, and there may be a problem in the chip itself. There may be a problem in the BIOS code that's being modified, that's taken from a third-party vendor that gives kind of a base set, and then they build customizations on top. Or it may actually be in their own code. In contrast, if you go up here on the other side, if you go up to that management layer, this is stables. This is middleware, effectively middleware, running on stable hardware. It is no different than, you know, from a software engineering design pattern-y kind of perspective. It is no different than any other big, large corporate middleware system that's managing some complex system. In this case, it just happens to be managing a bunch of hardware. But
James, this management layer is this top right corner.
Right? This top right corner.
Yeah, just want to point it out. Yeah.
So my background is mostly middleware. Were I to write code in here, it would look similar to what I spent much of my career doing. When you get down here, this is a world that I don't know well. Mitya does. But completely opposite ends of the spectrum. And that's the thing to take away here is that this particular product has thousands of engineers working on it concurrently. And that, even though it probably should have, you know, a third of that, but working on it concurrently, and the breadth of the type of engineering varies greatly based on which aspects of the product we're talking about. This is typically on-premise deployments. So this is, you have that additional complexity, that absorption cost is relatively high. Mitya, do you have any, you want to give any other insights that I may have missed here?
I think it was a good, more than overview, you know, good introduction, good detail. I would just add one thing that if you look at the left side, this blade motherboard detail, While, for example, the management layer, as James described, this top right corner, may stay the same more or less. The blade chassis will stay the same more or less. The left side, the blade motherboard, will change or will may get updated every 18 months. You know, depends on the CPU vendor cycle. The Intel CPU may become AMD CPU. The NICs will get also kind of upgraded with the industry to the industry standard bandwidth. The memory will also so all of that gets updated via a new blade being brought in. So a customer may have these blades installed at a time of initial installation, and then every 18 months or so, as they purchase more, they will get new kind of a up to date hardware, and with it will come up to, brand new BIOS. To the customer, it's not really that important that the BIOS is brand new, but actually to this discussion and to what was implemented in terms of Agile, this 18-month cycle was very important, and the timing of it was also very important, as James will go into later.
Thank you. Another thing I failed to mention is that this is, from the customer perspective, this is the product. It's this whole thing. Everything you see in orange is the product. From a less product definition perspective, this is the obvious product boundary. You leave this boundary and you're outside of the division. At this boundary, you can plug into, you can have, say, a router that's a competing company's router connect to it. This is the very natural product boundary for this, and it's how the customers would think about it. As to timeline, so there's this timeline that's in the case study. A lot of things are coming and going, a lot of things are happening that are discussed in the case study, and they're not always discussed chronologically. It's mostly chronologically, but I might focus on what's happening at the diagnostics team, and then at what's happening at the BIOS team may be happening a little bit concurrently to that. The timeline is really useful in helping kind of maintain the overall context of what's going on. If you were going to print something out and take notes on it, this would be the thing to print out and take notes on, so you could put notes on it. When I first got there, there were a variety of teams that were claiming to be doing Agile. But when I went and investigated what various teams were doing, the only thing you would see is Agile in name only. The realities were far from it. And so my key sponsor there wasn't Mitya, it was the person that was signing off on my pay cards, on my invoices. We started looking for, well, where can we go and find something that we can demonstrate what a good feature team looks like? And the thing we found was the diagnostic capability. This system did not have the ability to do diagnostics well in the field. We would have hardware returns that, you know, after multiple rounds of trying to solve a customer problem, and, you know, these customers are paying, losing millions of dollars, you know, every minute or so, these things are down sometimes, they would eventually give up, ship them brand new hardware, and then they would get that back on the bench, you know, a month later, and they wouldn't be able to find the problem. And so not only were they losing, you know, millions of dollars, or like probably tens of millions, I forget how big the numbers were, but they were way more than the team cost per month to deal with returns in the field. And what's worse is the customer experience for these poor system administrators that were on the other end, that the support teams were trying to help. You know, they were frustrated as could be with these sort of ghost in the machine type issues. Even if, you know, it worked pretty well for most people all the time, there's always, with so many systems out there, there's always, you know, some people that have problems, and there are hardware failures that happen. And so this was an effort to build some additional diagnostics capability. Each of these various components, like the custom NIC cards, the custom BIOS stuff, the throughout the system, there's a variety of custom hardware, custom ASIC chips, custom firmware, etc. And not always did that even have a instrumentation to perform diagnostics. So we pulled a team together where every, you know, what was effectively a component team that had the skill set to work on, you know, component X, everyone coughed up one person that joined this diagnostics team. And then the diagnostics team built out this new diagnostics functionality. The vast majority of the diagnostics was kind of contained and was code that others didn't really need to touch much. But occasionally there was a need to go into a particular subcomponent and add instrumentation to it. And so this team had the skills and the access to go do that. And it was the first team that had really done anything like a proper Scrum environment. And, you know, we put them all in a room, as you see here. And we delivered in a way that they'd never seen before. From a feature team adoption map perspective, it is mostly a vertical slice, which is exactly what you want. It truly was a true feature team. And within the narrow bounds of being a diagnostic component, it was, you know, end to end in that regard. There was even the ability to ship the custom ISO, the diagnostic ISO could be used in isolation on an individual node. If you wish to test the system as a whole, you had to wait for, you know, this waterfall release process to be able to catch a ride on to make it into that high level administration GUI. So you could like do it against a run test against a huge number of nodes all at once. But even incrementally, it had value sprint by sprint, increment by increment. So as I was doing that, healthy product boundary. So that is similar. You'll see this diagram in some of the less materials. This is effectively what we did. This feature team red is effectively what the diagnostics team was. We did not. I made the mistake of not dealing with enough of the organizational structure up front, which eventually came back to give us trouble. And we did have cases where people were being pulled off the teams and refocused, and we had to continually monitor that and put some management pressure to avoid it. Very senior management pressure so that the middle management wouldn't be problematic. And that had problems on its own. But nonetheless, it was about this time that Minty and I started talking, because this team was up and going and starting to yield some benefits. And I had managed to I'd managed to slowly start talking to Mitya and kind of bring him into the picture. And Mitya was responsible for this BIOS component. So at this point, Mitya, can you speak to this for me? I mean, just in general, like tell the story of, you know, you and I basically started dating, if you will.
Yeah, so, right. Yes.
Well, my wife would call my work wife, started dating. Right.
So as James mentioned, he was working within the business unit with other teams. Not with other software teams within the same business unit, and bringing them up to the Agile framework. You know, we knew each other. We had lunch together a couple times, but I, in my mind, not only in my mind, but I was told by mentors and senior people that firmware, you don't do Agile in firmware. BIOS, you don't do Agile in BIOS. It's so far down the software stack, and it's so close to hardware, and the cycles are hardware driven. You know, you're just the software who is enabling the hardware. You don't have your own kind of cycle, your own destiny on schedule. You're all dependent on how things are going in the lab. People are bringing up these fresh off the press boards and debugging and debugging new, bringing up new components, you know, new memory, new CPUs, new third-party network adapters, and so on. All of that doesn't, at the onset, doesn't seem like a natural thing to put in sprints and retrospectives and so on, which wasn't really true at all, as we discovered with James, working with James. But even putting that aside, you know, BIOS these days is a whole lot of software, just pure software, even though low level, as James described, it's C without libraries, which is an innovation of the last 20 years. Before that, it was assembly, but, you know, still just kind of pure C code. It's still software. It talks to, just talking through this picture, the BIOS communicates through the chassis controller to the management, to the GUI and the administrator on the top right. BIOS communicates the status of the system to this high level software. BIOS takes configuration from the high level software and configures the system as desired. So all of that is simply software features. They just happen to be on this kind of a low level environment. So I started talking more and more with James, and James kind of was educating me on Agile, and I was simply one of those people who knew about Agile without actually experiencing Agile. However, you know, one meeting that James set up one formal meeting to introduce aspects of Agile, and
getting the director involved in the diagnostic stuff to help brainwash you.
It was a 30-minute meeting that lasted probably 2.5 hours.
Yeah.
And the reason it lasted 2.5 hours is because it was interesting to me to hear the concepts that would be brought into the team with the framework, without the so much of a language of Agile. When you start listening to the framework and the benefits and kind of what comes with it, the engineers being in control of their own estimates and the concept of delivering code every so often, every few weeks, whatever the sprint is, and then retrospective and kind of the team environment, and manager sort of being out of the way mostly, except for removing the obstacles for the team and being the coach really for the engineers. So that spoke to me as something that should be adapted by the team, simply to make what I thought and still think of manager's job much easier, which is remove obstacles and coach and provide environment where people can excel, and so at that time we jumped in. I don't think it was a perfect timing also, which I think, I don't know, this is a time to retrospect on this. I think the timing of this introduction of Agile into our team was perfect, because we were on one of the refresh cycles of the CPU and the generation of this blade. And we were about to step into 18 months development and test and kind of QA acceptance and release cycle. And so that next 18 months would have defined if we ever do this Agile method or not. And we decided to do it, and I'll let James continue with his.
Oh, sure, sure. Thank you, Mithya. It was a pleasure. And he wasn't voluntold. He wanted this. I was just looking for where there was interest. which gets into the org structure, which is interesting. So when I showed up, we had this original engineering SVP, and the first time I said, and I was actually hired by who's called Trent in the case study. You'll see him down here. That's who was actually signing my paychecks, but I was really only brought in because he got this gal on board and this person as well. And the first meeting I had with the guy, he said, James, the real question here is not what you can do for me. The question is, how can I help you? And he made it really clear that anything I needed, all I had to do was go to him and he would make it happen. And I've never been as well supported at that level as I was at this client. I've had another client where I had wonderful support from the person who was signing my paychecks, but not so much above his level. Anyway, so this was the org chart. The people that were working on that high level code, the stuff that had that GUI, that is to say, the people that were working up here at the MCS GUI, they had a software VP that was actually sort of passive aggressive to the whole idea. So that is to say, the parts of the system that were most conducive to a standard software-based engineering, better software engineering technical excellence practices, and where one might naturally look to do something like Scrum, in that area, we didn't have good buy-in. In contrast, you know, here's like 4,000 engineers involved here, so across several geographies. In contrast, the quote, hardware VP that Mitya reported into was very supportive. And basically, as long as Mitya was on board, he would support whatever Mitya wanted, thought was made sense. And so it would have made more sense to have a vertical slice that cut all the way through what was really the real product boundary. But because of the level of the level of buy-in that we had and didn't have, we started here. We started here, which is to say, things that were under Mitya's purview, we completely reorganized the teams there. Even that was, people were working vastly more cross-functionally than they ever had before. But we were still kind of constrained to what was really a component team, even though the reality is that BIOS is so complex that there are components within components within components within components. Think of it like a whole operating system, and you know there's a multitude of things down there. And we did over time stretch ourselves so that we were had become an expanded, you know, an extended component team with an expanded boundary that was starting to stretch towards the surface. And we were beginning to get permission to go in and make changes all the way through the stack for things that related to the BIOS related aspects. But that never got as far as we wanted. So from a feature team adoption map, the original scope was what you see here in this purple. When we initially stood up the teams, you effectively had this blue boundary. And then we pushed ourselves, tried to work ourselves towards what you see as the green boundary. Unfortunately, 3 months into my engagement, I lost that key VP. And the new VP, SVP, was somewhat ambivalent. Yet we had enough momentum that things kept going for quite a while. In other words, actually for a year. And we continued to make a dent. But that is an interesting dynamic. In the end, when Mitya lost his hardware VP as part of some major layoffs that were going to happen, and people started jumping ship before it even happened, which is what happened in this case, then all of a sudden Mitya was now reporting into that passive aggressive guy who didn't really want it in the first place, and that sort of thing started to fall apart. And we could talk about, you know, how could I have better avoided that? It's an interesting question for Q&A. From the overview perspective, let's just be aware that there were some very significant management dynamics. From a people distribution, there were people in Portland, people in the San Francisco area, Silicon Valley area, and there were teams in India. What we did as far as Mitya's people is everyone that reported into Mitya, we stood up, we did all the training, launched the teams, figured out definition of done, figured out working agreements, figured out our cadence. And for the teams that were working on the new version of the product, we that's who we put in this new structure. And then as some teams, as some US-based teams finished up some work on fixing bugs and such for some older generations of the product, we rolled them into this structure and slowly grew it. But we didn't deal with India, and we had kind of delayed that until we had proven that we had enough success, and then we were going to use the conflict that would come up to solve that. And I think it would have worked had we not had a layoff that really kicked us in the butt. The other thing here, here is some initial product backlog refinement that we did. We did brainstorming for 2 or 3 days. Then over time, over the course of the first few weeks, we flushed out and pulled things out of people's heads that had never been pulled out of their heads, and threw it all on a wall and managed to slowly massage it into this. What you see here is really like a snake-shaped product backlog, where this isn't a forced ranked order. You just have to read it right. And then we threw it all back into electronic tool. Here's our helper who would show up. This is Mitya's daughter. Here is an initial definition of done, kind of drafted. Here is what it looked like.
James,
yes, sir. Go ahead.
Maybe going back to the definition of done and even pulling things out of people's heads. I always, you know, I think that this was, we can stay here. Something that James reminds me, and if, even though this is written with my handwriting, it's really me noting down what the team dictated. You know, this is people really wanted this. People really wanted to have accountability across the team. That's universal. People really wanted to have universal definition of done, and you know, with this number, for example, number 8 point, I was arguing that this severity 3 defects, you know, you can live with from sprint to sprint, but you know, they convinced me that no, once it's done, it's done, and something that is severity 3, it isn't an extremely severe defect, but it's still usually, at least at that organization, a defect that gets fixed by the release of the product, or exceptionally deferred, but very exceptionally, most of the severity 3 would have to be fixed by the release of the product. So the team argued that, you know, no, every sprint we should fix this so that we don't go back and fix things. So it's this is kind of a good reminder for me, at least, that the team wanted this. And also, you know, for pulling things out of people's head, was the timing of this engagement was critical to being able to do that. You know, it's not maybe not the place to go into details of why we had to do it, but just the nature of the CPU cycle and BIOS coexistence is that BIOS is largely new every 18 months. And depending on how carefully you craft the custom code and segment off the common code, the process of CPU refresh is easier or harder. And so in this beginning of this 18-month cycle, we really wanted to sit down and see what is our custom code, what are the how does it function even, and how do we split it down into this, as James guided us, into user stories and kind of components by which somebody could assemble it in the future, if you will. So those two, yeah, those two, just wanted to highlight those two aspects of this process.
One of the things I found fascinating here was the degree of knowledge scatter. So among say 40 people, there was typically only one or two people that knew any particular facet of the system, and they had basically done hardware bring up, you know, half a dozen times over the course of, you know, the last 5 or 10 years. And they'd basically been doing copy paste reuse over and over and over again. I didn't have to nudge much at all. They were tired of the situation themselves. They had just never been in a place where they were empowered to solve it. And there was an issue of they had to decide, you know, this working cross-functional and cross-subcomponent, it's really not cross-component so much as cross-subcomponent, the components within BIOS, that was new to them because they were used to like, hey, only one or two people know how to touch that file, not that subsystem, but that file. I mean, it was that severe. And what you see here wasn't really any outside person telling us what needed to happen. This was the teams brainstorming, and we were in a big room with windows, a corner room with windows that we were putting sticky notes on the wall for about 2 days, where we would brainstorm it a bit, put sticky notes on the wall, merge these into a consolidated whole, do it again. And, you know, I facilitated a little, Mitius facilitated a little. Before long, we just had other, you know, random people in the team facilitating so they could, you know, they were learning to do it themselves. And it took a long, long time to get that information out of people's heads and into the common, into the collective knowledge of the teams as a whole. That had never happened before. And then we drilled down a little deeper. The people who knew the most about a thing would spend some time flushing that aspect out more. And then once everyone who knew about, you know, what were basically really crude sticky notes had flushed them out in a little bit more detail, then we got everyone together as again across the teams, and we went through it again. And, you know, we did some affinity estimation. We had to figure out what is a natural, what could we actually go to production with if we had to, and that's that red line there, and everything else is kind of nice to have. At least this has to happen for it to have functionality comparable to what came before for the previous generation of the blade. I put this in here for some reason. Oh, mostly this is just slides from the, this is all the slides from the case study. This emphasizes the point that you have to deal with structural elements and reward systems and processes and people and the whole system if you really want to change things. Here's some triage guidelines, again, not key to the conversation. The one thing before we switch over, which is really good stuff, is I have a plan to run a less practitioner course in Atlanta, Dublin, and Dubai. So Atlanta is the 21st and the 23rd. Dublin is 22nd through the February 22nd through March 2nd. Dubai is March 14th through the 16th. All of them are listed at my website, just on that CLP portion of the website. You can sign up for all of them. And here is something Stackleather wrote. I'll just let you read. So I'm new to this. I ran my first course last week. It's a real small course here in Milwaukee. I'm not new to training, but I'm new to running this particular course, and running it in a public context is new to me. And the good news is, so the course is based on a skeleton of a system modeling discussion where people work through how various design element, organizational design elements influence each other, how that influences adaptability. I go back and forth between the system modeling, which is entirely abstract of any particular framework, And then we spend time binding that to how does Les do it? Not so much because it's important to understand how Les does it, but I find that if it's entirely abstract, people don't quite know what to do with it. And so by spending some time saying, well, perhaps in your organizational design that wouldn't work, but if you had an organization designed this way, you could see that it would work. Now, that might not be the only way to build an organization that would do that, that is aligned with the, in this case, the system optimizing goal is highest level adaptiveness in the service of learning and delivering highest level value. But at least it's one concrete example of a design pattern of how you could build your org. And if you did build it this way, many of the problems that people are teaching themselves, and they're teaching themselves as much as me teaching them, that they're teaching themselves as they do the system modeling, instead of just being frustrated and depressed because how could I ever do anything like this, there's light at the end of the tunnel. They see what would be possible, and then that kind of helps with retention, which is my real intention, is to it's not what I cover, it's what people learn and retain. And the good news is this guy on the right, he had trouble sleeping the first night because he was so busy thinking through how he could do something with everything he was learning. So as a test of, is my course working? You know, I'm new to running this course, but the fact that he's up all night trying to process such and reconcile all the different things he's learned and taught himself in class, that means that I'm doing something right. And I owe a lot of that to the value of the system model that Craig uses that I'm using as well. Most of what's on the right is at least half me, if not entirely me. Anyway, here it is. That's it. Mitya, anything before we turn it over and go to QA, which is really where the really good stuff is?
I don't think so. I think let's do QA.
Okay.
Q&A.
So who's got cool questions for us? And however you want to moderate that, Anthony.
Yeah, so thank you very much for that, James and Mitra. So if people want to put questions into chat, come off mic, whatever you feel comfortable with. There's one question here in chat. I'll read it out, if that's okay, James.
Sure.
If I understand there was no product owner / single person or similar who defined the what priority for teams, roadmap, et cetera, technical backend product or feature collection, is it interesting to see how the team need is met?
Okay, so we did. Because our boundary, Mitya played that role. Because our boundary was so compromised, what I would have preferred is that someone in product management, sorry, it's a little slow to navigate this way. My preference would be that someone in product management was actually acting as a product owner. But in our initial product boundary way down here, the reality is it took someone very technical to understand this very detailed backlog. And so we used, unless there's a guide to use a start with a fake product owner, it's a guide or experiment, I forget which. And so we ended up with Mitya having to play that role, and which he did well. But it's fair to say that that wasn't a real product owner. But it's also true that, you know, when you're doing this kind of work, the teams know so much. I mean, so Mitya would make judgments as to, where did this go? You know, just how much of this can we actually go ahead and ship? But it was really a collective wisdom of everybody. Mitya, you want to speak to that better than I can?
I can speak to that. I don't know better, but I'll speak to that. I acted as a product owner effectively. Although, you know, as a BIOS, you know, BIOS as a software component in the system, we had very clear definitions of what, you know, what needed to be delivered, you know, which hardware components we support, which memory SKUs, et cetera, which CPU SKUs, which software features to interact with, integrate and interact with the higher level software, management software of these blades. So all of that, as an overall product, this as a system was defined. So my job was to translate those definitions of the overall system and the product specs, if you will, of the overall system, the features of the overall system, into what does BIOS need to do to support them, and how are we as a BIOS team, BIOS software team, organize ourselves to support them, and when do we deliver what? What is the minimal viable product, etc. So it's not, So I was, as James mentioned, a temporary product owner. Although, again, I wasn't necessarily defined. I think that's what made it possible for me to be the temporary product owner. I wasn't defining the overall product. I was defining how and when BIOS delivers on its software promises, so that the overall system, who had its own product manager, would function as designed, as promised to the customer.
And I would say in the next generation of the product, had things continued, as they were, we would have been able to stretch that up and change that. So once we got to the point that, for years and years, they had been doing copy paste reuse and had not been using a pluggable layer. And then bringing up a new board was basically repeating that work. Again, it's the reason it took 18 months instead of, several months with really good build systems and automation and pluggable layers. Yes, there'd be problems, but it wouldn't be the problem that it had been in the past. And we would have been able to start defining product backlog items in terms of what does it do for the customer, the true customer, that is to say the person who buys that whole thing on a forklift, not what does it do in terms of implementing some API that high level orchestration system needs to see in order to be able to pull it into this federation of hardware.
I'll also add to this question something we didn't talk a lot about is that there was, in this overall product delivery, there was a lot of interaction between the Agile team and the Waterfall teams. There's lots of teams within this overall big product that were, in the write software, send it to QA, get back the software, get back the bugs, fix the bugs, send it back to QA, do regression cycle, fix out the bugs, and ship. That cycle. And so maybe part of this question, Lane, is that if what James was trying to do would have continued, and other software teams within that organization would have eventually become agile, having a single person for the whole product, not just BIOS, but the whole product, would have been extremely beneficial and would make effectively my job easier and would let me focus more on the team. Although I, to be very honest, I kind of question, not question, but I wouldn't want to be completely removed from kind of technical discussion and just be the coach and obstacle remover, as I know a manager should be. I still would want to somehow be involved in the technical aspect of it. But yes, having a product owner for this whole picture, not just the BIOS component, would have been beneficial. Maybe we should move on to other questions.
Well, to Mithya's point, yeah. I think what would have happened here is in the next generation of the product, if I had not lost my stop doing that. How do I get back to? Come on, PowerPoint. Had I not lost this SVP, what would have happened in the next generation is Minty and I would have gone to this guy, you know, looping in the hardware VP, and we probably would have managed to pull together a team that had the skills that, that took people that traditionally were working on these higher level components and put them on, make true feature teams. And I have a feeling that this SVP here would have brought this software VP into line. Either he would have been ejected or he would have come on board. And that's what it would have taken to really do that. We were doing it sort of guerrilla. You know, we were slowly, organically chewing into that layer, although we weren't officially, you know, responsible for that layer, for these upper layers. We were getting into that code, and the teams that were working on them were so overburdened that they were happy to have us do the work and then just have them review it. So, but eventually, had we been more successful and continued doing that, it would have been a threat to this software VP, and somehow something bad mostly would have happened, most likely, and we would have needed the positional authority of the SVP to line things out. And this is what happens when you don't get enough buy-in early on and you don't do something like a certified less for executives type course, which I didn't have the wisdom and skill set to do at the time. But that was probably a mistake. Something I would do differently in the future, and it would have avoided a lot of the problems you see in the case study. Yeah, but let's go ahead. Next question. Whatever you think, Anthony.
All right, thank you. So I'm just going to take them in order. So what was compromised about a boundary? Did you mean the product self or mixed buy-in from the organization?
Say it again. Did I mean what?
Sorry, what was compromised about the boundary? Did you mean the product itself or the mixed buy-in from the organization?
Okay, I was referring to the product. Specifically, I was referring to the product boundary and the fact that, you know, the real product boundary, that's the real product boundary, that orange thing, the whole down thing, figure one. That's what the customer thinks is the product. We started with this compromised boundary where it was just the BIOS teams, even though we did pull in, as you'll see, we pulled in the QA. You see the testers from the testing group that were formerly still in the testing group. We treated them as just another team member, and some of the people that traditionally just did firmware development were doing testing, and some of the testers were doing firmware development. And, you know, that was the day-to-day operational reality, although the formal reporting reality was they were the testers were still reporting through the quality assurance VP. But because we had her buy-in, the day-to-day operational behavior was healthy. Perhaps not structurally stable, but healthy in the short term. So I was referring to that aspect. Is there another, did I miss any part of the question, or any, whoever asked it, would you like to follow up, clarify anything?
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. All right.
Hey, James. Question. Yes. Sorry, just wanted to piggyback. This is Madeline. Hey, would you mind saying more why a broader product definition, right, is more valuable? Because I feel like we're talking a little bit around the edges of that as you're trying to expand it.
Well, because the customer doesn't give a blank about what some low-level BIOS functionality does. All they care about is, you know, and nor does a CEO, right? They care about stuff that helps the actual end user do cool stuff that they want to do, that they need to do, which that whole thing does. That is to say that, you know, that orange boundary, that's how they look at the product. And we have the advantage here of, since this is a real product company that sells a, you know, packaged, shrink-wrapped product, yes, it's not completely shrink-wrapped because it has, you know, consulting services and implementation services and blah, blah, blah. So it's not quite like going to the Apple store and buying an iPhone. But in large measure, you know, it's a thing that people buy. And that's much different than, say, a banking system where the real product is, you know, equities trading or, you know, something like that. And the software is just an enabling component of that overall system. At least in this case, if you went to product management and you asked what the product boundary was, you know, it would almost be a stupid question. They know what the product boundary is. Take that with a grain of salt. Explaining, understanding your product boundary is much slipperier than it sounds. The truth is the real product probably does include those consulting services and the broader aspects. And it does perhaps include maybe some additional network hardware that might be in front of this system, which may or may not be made by the same company. You could swap it out with a different competitor. Does that answer your question, Madeline?
Sure. I was just trying to think through, you know, and help maybe other people, right, who haven't had the benefit of taking even, right, a less practitioner class and thinking about the organizational implications of stuff, right, particularly like product boundary.
Yeah. Sure. These people are lucky in the sense their boundary is obvious, quasi-obvious. So at least the more ideal boundary is obvious, not the boundary that we ended up starting with, which was compromised.
Well, and though you didn't get to expand it as far as you wanted, right, in this transformation, did you see any increased product complexity? And how did you work through any of that?
I don't understand the question, Madeline. I don't understand the increased product complexity portion of the question.
Oh, you know what? So, sorry, let me be more verbose, right? So I'm reflecting a little bit of my own sort of systems modeling training, right? Thinking about as we have a broader product definition, oftentimes that increases product complexity.
Oh, right? Yes, that's certainly true.
Address that. So I was just curious if you experienced that, right? Even at the stage you got to with this transformation and how you dealt with it.
It certainly added technical complexity because now the team, from the perspective, not at a systems level, it made things simpler because, you know, these feature teams would have had the ability to touch everything. Certainly that was true within diagnostics. They did have the ability to touch everything and it, you know, things got way better, way fast. You know, there's an initial learning curve, but within a sprint or two, they're doing stuff that's never been done before. But it's fair to say that, you know, the team struggles as they grow and learn these skills, and especially because we had that compromised support in the org chart as it pertains to the software VP. The sensible thing to have done would have been to had some of the people that were currently reporting into that software VP come over and join the teams as full team members. That would have been the sensible thing to do. Since that was not the case, you end up with firmware engineers that only know their firmware world that are now having to cross-train themselves and learn other aspects of the system that they haven't. Now, the good news is we had the testers on the team, and whereas the firmware engineers that formerly reported into Mitria, you know, they've been living in that small silo for years. The testers that came over, that is to say, you know, these triangle people, they may not have understood the low-level details of any given component, but they understood how to test the system end-to-end. And they brought a tremendous value that they brought to the table. Dimitri, am I missing anything here? Yeah.
No, not missing. I would add to the technical complexity in certain areas, the technical complexity increased. And I'm trying to answer this without going too much into the BIOS specifics, but it, due to their not very wide usefulness. BIOS has been and is less so now, but historically has been very kind of segmented, knowledge-wise segmented industry. So there was a, you know, person who does memory, person who does processor, person who does, you know, boot from hard disk, and those people are kind of for the most part free to do what, you know, what they want as long as the product works and as long as the external specifications of the specifications of any kind of external consumers of what they produce are met. And here we took all of that and we presented it to the whole team, and now we have Scrum teams, and by and large any Scrum team can pick any component, any user story. So now a person who wrote the code that does boot from disk is watching another team take it apart, and another team is trying to take it apart and making something else with it, ultimately formalizing a lot of interfaces, ultimately making the segments more reusable in the future, and you know, it's for everyone's good. But oftentimes, you know, to answer your question directly, the complexity does increase with that, because it's not, you know, sometimes the code that I write for something I know how to do and I promise that it works, it may not be as complex as the code that has formal interfaces.
Thank you for expanding on that. Really appreciate it, James. Timothea.
Yeah.
You're very welcome, sir.
There was another question.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are some more questions in. Can you tell us more about the wall? The hood, sticky category on the wall.
Okay. I'll get to it the other way. Sticky. This stuff. Mitra, you tell this story really well. The couple days we spent in the room mostly putting sticky notes on a window.
Yeah. Was there a specific category that said, or was this, maybe there was this a question about some specific part of that sticky note, or just in general?
If said the part.
Is it maybe, James, maybe there was a...
Can the person clarify? Can the requester get on mic and explain the question a little better for us?
Yeah, Sherry, if you can explain.
Oh, the huh sticker.
We can come back to it if you want. Okay, yeah. Sherry, if it's available, I can go on to the next question. For the introduction, was co-location necessary? Recommended for new teams considering this, or what is the extra you got that pertains to non-co-location?
So these teams start when we started, so that is before we did the adoption at all. There wasn't a lot of attention paid to co-location. Mitria, I may be a little off there, but I know that we had, you know, people that were in Silicon Valley that were doing some of the work that was then, you know, perhaps being tested by a group in Portland, by some people in Portland, and there just wasn't a lot of attention paid to that. When we decided to do this, we set up our teams to all be co-located. So we, when we did the training in Silicon Valley, we made sure to go to that the VP on the QA side and have her send a few testers to the group. And we trained them along with the Demetrius people. And when it came to training the Portland folks, we did the same thing. We were able to find some testers that were doing some other work on some other parts of the system and bring them into training and have them be part of the team. And then within the first sprint or two, we were to the point that the people in Portland had all the skill set, they were cross-functional enough. That is to say, they had, you know, enough testing capability, enough firmware skill set, et cetera, to work as an independent team. And the same was true in San Jose. We stood up like two or three teams there, and to start with, we stood up two teams there, and then later added on more. And each of those were co-located from the day one, from when we did this adoption. Is that, any follow-up question on that?
No follow-up.
Okay. I mean, you just can't beat co-location if you're really after adaptiveness.
James, I'm gonna be cheeky. So if you had to do it in a not like dispersed
what's the one thing that you need to have in your back pocket or
Say that again.
If you had to do it in a dispersed manner, what is the one thing you need to do extra or above that you wouldn't have to do because of the co-location factor that helps?
And by dispersed, you're referring to people are working remotely and no one is in a physically co-located in an office, or that you have a few clusters of co-located people, but they're not in the same geography?
They're not in the same geography.
Okay. Well, except you're going to take a huge hit for that, right? You may find yourself where you have no choice but to do it. Maybe there's a skill set that's just tremendously missing. My first reaction is to build it co-located, you know, deal with that problem up front, deal with the pain, and then as you deal with the people will cross-train themselves. The problem is so severe that you really need to somehow get management on board. So instead of trying to live with the problem, if you can in some way change the structure, if you set up, you know, people say, oh, here's a garden, go please grow some wonderful plants that, you know, produce lots of fruit in this new garden. But by the way, we're not going to let you fix the soil before you do so. And, you know, there's all these problems in the soil and it's malnourished, you know, unhealthy soil, and you're never going to be that successful. Now, if what you're dealing with is everyone works remotely for whatever reason, and there's some trade-offs there of what is in the best interest of the product and being as adaptable as possible and delivering the most value as possible versus balancing work-life balance and people being able to stay home and, you know, spend more time with their kids. And, you know, there's a trade-off situation there. And there's certainly a trade-off situation if their compensation structures are not adjusted for when the product wins, they individually, personally win, right? So if you don't have the authority to go after the compensation structures. And so then that's about like, well, at least keep people in similar time zones. Do everything you can to lower the friction as much as possible. I'm using a teleprompter. I love this thing. It mostly lets me look directly at people when I'm speaking, especially in small meetings where there's only two or three people on the Miro, et cetera, et cetera. And then, of course, you know, coming together in person occasionally whenever you can. But there's no way to get around the fact that, you know, having teams that are 12-hour time zone differences from each other, that, you know, even if they're co-located in their each offices, you know, the way to solve that is to make sure that each region is independent, even though they're still part of the same overall product development group, consumed from the same product backlog, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. Okay. I got it. Thank you.
You're welcome. I mean, that may not be the answer you want to hear, but like, I think that's just the physics of the work.
Yeah, you know, there is a cost in non-co-located teams. And I was just wondering if there was anything that you come across that was the silver bullet.
There's no silver bullet. There's lots of, you know, compensating ideas, right? And none of them are great, but they're maybe better than not doing them, you know. Next question, I guess. Anthony?
Yeah. So do you use any method to manage cross-team dependencies?
Ah. We don't have no stinking cross-team dependencies. And that's a partial truth. It is true within those BIOS teams that wasn't a problem. And they would they could always go talk to their peers in another team to get help. You know, you'll see like, you know, component mentors and this sort of pattern. It is true that because of the compromised product boundary, they would have to work with other teams that were in this waterfall structure in order to get, you know, stuff that went up through the administrative GUI working. And, but there wasn't like some complicated, you know, dependency tracking mechanisms we used. We probably did something within, we were using Raleigh, and we probably had, you know, some dependent tickets in Raleigh, but mostly this was much more organic than that. Mitria, any comments there? I may have misrepresented. It's been so long.
Yeah, I think we, I'm also trying to remember if we had any at least significant cross-team dependencies. We tried not to, of course. At least I can say that cross-team dependency isn't something that stands out as either the problem that we solved or the problem, a problem.
Yeah, I just don't remember it being a significant problem that we had. Perhaps had we kept going and had our other big problems go away, maybe it would have become so. But it just we had a lot of big problems, and that wasn't at the top of the list.
Yeah, it could also be unique to the nature of the BIOS as a software, and literally, if you imagine if you open up a PC, like a desktop computer, literally every component of that visually that you see has some kind of a BIOS software equivalent that enables it. And so perhaps that's one reason that, they're kind of more or less independent. But, we didn't drive certain teams to take on certain any kind of specific user stories, but whatever teams did take on, I think the bottom line is I don't remember it being a problem.
Now, there were teams case. That had affinities. So
yeah.
There ended up being one team that had more of the middleware type skills on it that tended to do more of the work that went up to that administrative console. And they were sort of the leading team as it pertained to pushing into that boundary. So that's kind of a natural thing that happens sometimes. So teams would certainly have, areas of stronger competency than their sister teams of one flavor or another.
Thank you. So do you believe co-location has helped implementing less effectively?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I don't have a lot of everything you'll read about it is true. I mean, about co-location, forget about less. Just it really does make a huge difference. I mean, I think Alistair Cockburn wrote about that years ago. Nothing has changed other than, sure, the remote tools are better than they used to be, but they're still not the same as face-to-face.
Thank you. I can see the pros and cons. But just another question. Do you have combined backlog redefinement with all teams involved in a separate backlog refinement with each team?
So we usually did it. We pretty much did it as a group, and it was pretty organic. Mitria, can you remember? This situation was a little different than the, if you read less books, you'll see multi-team refinement described, which among other things is focused on knowledge transfer between the stakeholders who are, customers, users that are looking for functionality and the teams. And there's a lot of effort on, there's a lot of emphasis on, direct interaction between the team members and these external SMEs that are using the product and have some need that the teams are hoping to fix or to address. In this case, as Mitya explained earlier, to some extent, these blades had to come up and implement the same protocol that they'd always implemented in the previous generation of the blade and in the previous generation before that and in the previous generation before that. It is true that there was a tiny amount of additional functionality that, you know, the administrative console might be able to do one or two new things. Maybe the new chipset enabled some new capability of some sort that needed to be integrated into the whole of the product as a whole. But mostly they were implementing the same API infrastructure that they had always implemented in previous generations. So it's 95%, 98% do the same thing that it used to do in the old generation of the hardware. And so it is the multi-team refinement activities were about the teams helping each other understand what needs done. And, you know, we did have refinement meetings, and we would do, and I don't know, and these didn't always align with sprint boundaries, sorry, with team boundaries. It was, you know, whoever knew the most about these aspects would go and do it. And then because of the weird nature of this particular thing, because we were plowing old ground that had been plowed millions and, you know, hundreds, not hundreds, tens of times before, so much of what needed to be done was flushed out in that in those first few weeks. And there was perhaps 30 to 40% maybe of stuff that they weren't sure about that would come up as they discovered and did more work. Oh, we have the new thing to do that we didn't anticipate. But the backbone was pretty clear. And that's because of the nature of the product, the nature of where they were in trying to implement more technical excellence than historically it happened, and so much effort was being put into improving the quality in this pass in a way that had never happened before. But they weren't at the place where the requirements were real or the needs were very dynamic in a very dynamically changing market. That would eventually, when the product boundary, when you expanded it and things got better and you had a real product boundary, that would make sense. You know, the market needs would change. You would need that dynamicism. You would need people that are using the product in multi-team refinement to do this kind of thing. But with this compromised product boundary, or really component boundary, that wasn't the case to the extent it would otherwise be. Did that answer the question?
I think so. Yeah. So no other questions have come in. So I'm going to say thank you very much, James and Mitra. That was very informative. And yeah, so you can reach James on his website if you have any further questions, or you can send them to Agile Lean Ireland, and we're very happy to forward them on. Thank you very much, James. Thank you very much, Mitra, for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, everyone. Right, thank you, James, for this opportunity once again.